This is Sphinx Radio, exploring the enigmas of the ages and the puzzles of the present, with your host, William H. Kennedy.
Professor Robert Schock, welcome back to Sphinx Radio.
Well, thank you very much.
Now, Professor Schock, you came out with a really wonderful book I highly recommend called The Parapsychology Revolution, a concise anthology of paranormal and psychical research. And that it's really a wonderful book for anyone who's interested in paranormal matters at all. Now, you had a co-author with this who helped you compile it. Who would that be?
Yeah, that's correct. That's Logan Yanovyak, and she has since graduated, but she was actually a student of mine at Boston University, and she expressed an interest in the paranormal, parapsychology, that type of thing. And basically one thing led to another, and she ended up putting this together with me. What we did was we read literally thousands and thousands of papers, both pro and con, and we weeded that down to 14, what we consider, a combination of both important, seminal, and also accessible papers that we anthologized in this volume, along with about 100 pages of our own commentary.
A very good, Professor, and again, for anyone interested in paranormal studies, parapsychology, psychical research, this book is really fantastic. It's 432 pages. It's put out by Tarcher Press. It's a 2008 book. And could you give us out your webpage, Professor, if people
sure.
want more information?
Yeah, I'm happy to. It's www.robertschock, all one word, and that's spelled robertschock.com. So www.robertschock.com.
Robertschock.com. Very good, Professor. Now, I'm curious, this was really a wonderful book. I couldn't put it down myself. I read through it twice.
Thank you.
I was curious as to why. Now, you're a professor in the hard sciences. What is your exact title?
My title, I think, at the moment is Associate Professor of Natural Sciences and Mathematics. And my PhD is in Geology and Geophysics. From Yale. So yes, it's the hard sciences.
So as someone from the hard sciences, usually things like parapsychology are greatly frowned upon. Have you gotten any resistance from colleagues or within the academic community?
I honestly don't try to push it in their face too much.
Right.
So I try to avoid that. But yes, I mean, people, it's really a taboo subject to this day. And a lot of people, I find that the people who are most vehement against it, the arch debunkers or the people that just dismiss it with a wave of the hand, are the ones that have not bothered to look into it. Sort of ignorance, I don't know if it's the same, but ignorance breeds contempt. They just really don't know anything about. I want to comment that when we went into this, Logan and I went into this, we were planning to put together initially an anthology that would be split 50-50, sort of pro and con, papers supporting the concept that there's a validity, there's some reality to the paranormal, and we would also put in papers that really, argued the other side. After going through thousands and thousands of papers, research reports, etc., the book, which is an honest thing, really is all pro-paranormal, pro-parapsychology, that yes, there is something to it, it's real, it needs to be studied, and that is in large measure because the anti-papers, the papers against parapsychology in the literature, they're really little more. We found the name-calling, making excuses, suggesting that people have poor experimental procedures or they're simply faking the data. It's really quite amazing what I'll call the skeptics and the debunkers do.
Well, that's odd because they do quickly devolve into mudslinging and don't really look at any of the hard facts.
Exactly, and so we did not want to include mudslinging papers in our anthology. So it ended up, some people say to me, well, it ended up with an anthology that is all pro, you know, pro-parapsychology. And yeah, I said, that's right, because as hard as we tried, we really couldn't find anything that we thought was worthy of including on the other side. It was just, like you said, the mudslinging.
Well, that's fascinating, Professor. Now, you mentioned earlier that you have a strong background in mathematics. A big argument I always hear against parapsychology is that a lot of the things that, like Professor Rhine did and some of the things they did at the Princeton lab, were in the realm of mathematical chance, and it could be explained like that. Now, mathematically speaking, are there people or individuals who possess some sort of extraordinary power that defies mathematical statistics?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, one thing that we plan on the book, and I want to mention one article by Jessica Utz, who is a very good mathematician, statistician, and we included one of her classic articles where she goes through a lot of the parapsychological literature, does analysis and meta-analysis, and basically every study like that, and hers is one example, and one of the, we thought, a very good example to include in the anthology, but when you actually look at the data and you look at it objectively and you apply the proper statistical procedures to it, you know, not hokey ones that are made to get the outcome you want, namely that there's nothing statistically significant, when you really look at it objectively, there is consistently, not in every experiment, but consistently over the course of the majority experiments, over the course of the bulk mass of data, there is what I call information leakage. There's something coming through. There is something there that needs to be explained. And I'd like to point out that a lot of the modern statistical procedures that we use every day now in all the sciences, they were actually developed and honed in the late 19th, early 20th century specifically to apply to psychical studies, because you do have data here where you have to tease out the signal versus the noise, if we could use that analogy. You know, in some cases, and I think this is in large part due to the nature of the data, the nature of the subject matter. It's not the type of subject, as much as scientists love experimental laboratory studies, it doesn't lend itself well to experimental research in many cases. So the classic Rhine studies you referred to, card calling experiments, that type of thing, to see if you could go above statistical chance. He demonstrated over and over you can, but it's still, all things being equal, a relatively weak statistical significance, but consistent. So that is really what you're looking for in those types of experimental cases. To use another analogy, not to beat into the ground, but you use the same types of statistical procedures when testing the efficacy of drugs. You know, a new drug, how effective is it going to be? And if in those cases they got as good results as we often get in parapsychological studies, you know, the drug is considered a wonder drug. All of a sudden, you know, twice as many people are saved from heart attacks, and it may be very small numbers in huge populations, but there's no question it's statistically significant. Then when people look at parapsychological studies, sometimes the same people, they apply a totally different criteria. They raise the bar higher. Again, it's just playing games, if I would. This is something I've really grappled with, and there's no doubt in my mind that there is statistical significance to the experimental studies.
Very good. That was an excellent answer, Professor. Now, one question I had for you, this sort of thing doesn't get very much funding.
No.
You know, they closed down the Princeton lab a couple years ago.
Yeah, it was just lack of funding, and, you know, Bob John, who ran it, retired, and it's very sad, actually.
It is very sad because that was one of the places where they were really setting up rigorous, you know, test conditions and very hard things. And but they sent a lot of people who claim to have paranormal powers walking out the door saying, we don't see any that you have, you know. So they didn't rubber stamp everyone who walked into their lab. They turned more people away.
And that tradition of not rubber stamping everyone, I want to point out, goes back to at least the 1880s, if not before. But when I say at least the 1880s, with the establishment in London of the Society for Psychical Research, a lot of people, they upset a lot of people on both sides, because on the one hand, they were finding statistically and through rigorous studies right from the 1880s that, yes, there's something there. So they upset the apple cart for the conventional scientists who didn't want to believe it. They also upset the other side, should we say, because a lot of people would come in claiming that they had powers, so to speak, and they demonstrate they were either frauds or just mistaken. And the Pear Labs, too, did that. And I think this is actually part of the funding issue. It's like, where do you get funding from? Do you get funding from people who, you know, sort of, organizations that pride themselves on having paranormal powers, be into the psychical, you know, sort of that aspect. But then, you know, when you've got scientists, they may say, well, person X and person Y don't really have much in the way of psychical powers, which is not to say there's nothing to it, but they may not have it. On the other hand, you get funding from the status quo. They don't want to hear about any of this stuff. It's going to blow their whole world view. So the whole funding problem is a horrible mess. Anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no problem. It's all very fascinating stuff, and I just wanted to add that Arthur Koestler left some money for psychical research at the University of Edinburgh, but there were problems there because it was later discovered he was a wife beater or some other insignificant reason.
Yeah,
you know, that had nothing to do with psychical. They didn't like his personality or something, so they cut a lot of that out, too. So they'll use any excuse.
Exactly. That's the bottom line. They'll use any excuse. And it's really tough. And, you know, it's a tough field. It's a taboo subject. Really, the people that do go into it and do anything with it, in many cases, you know, they have to have jobs otherwise. You know, you're not going to make a living off of this. It has to be sort of on the side, a hobby. I mean, there's been very few exceptions over the last 150 years. The Princeton labs, which are now shut down, were an exception. While it was going, the parapsychology division, I don't know if that was the official name, but University of Edinburgh was an exception. You know, but they use, like you said, they use excuses. They find other reasons to shut it down.
It's very strange. The U.S. military actually did a lot of psychical research in the 70s and 80s, which they eventually lost funding to. But it's very, very strange because the funding cuts came for other reasons. The actual military people themselves, like Steppelbaum and a few others who were in the military, saw great value in this kind of thing. It's very odd, and they got cut back in the general troop reduction. There again, this sort of thing was the first thing to go when there was any kind of, financial or fiscal cutbacks at all. It's very strange.
Exactly, and I think that, in my own feeling, is that's for a couple of reasons. One, you know, because it is a taboo subject. It's, you know, people are skeptical about. So I hate to say it this way, but you get bureaucrats who don't really know anything about it, and it's easy pickings for them. You know, if you have to make cuts somewhere, well, then why not cut this stuff, which, you know, they don't understand. They've got, you know, should we say status quo types, conservatives saying, oh, it's all nonsense anyway, even if it is producing real results. And, of course, too, with military uses of this, like anything, you know, they used it a lot for spying, essentially. A remote viewing, they would call it, that type of thing. And it's been proven to be useful to give good information, which, of course, is militarily useful. But then there's a whole other branch of the military. They rather put or another way of thinking about it, they rather put their money and emphasis into electronic gear, you know, bugs, that type of thing.
Or even bombs, which are much worse than training a psychic.
Exactly. So you got all kinds of things going against you. I wanted to point out something else. I was talking about laboratory experiments, and we were talking about statistical analysis, that type of thing. I am a geologist, geophysicist. And something I like to often point out is that, in a way, I think paranormal phenomena, genuine paranormal phenomena, are very similar to a lot of geologic phenomena in the sense that they occur when they occur, when nature says they occur, so to speak. I mean, many people, they have a very intense paranormal experience, you know, and they can't predict they're going to have that, you know. Maybe a good friend of theirs dies, and they just know it immediately. But they can't predict that's going to happen. You don't go killing their friend to see if they get a telepathic impression. Do you see what I mean?
Sure, so it's kind of like earthquakes. They come when they come.
It's very hard to bring into the laboratory. Yeah. And to use a geology example, you know, a lot of volcanologists, they study volcanoes, right? You don't all of a sudden have a volcanic eruption on command in your laboratory. You can't even go into the field and, like, command when the volcano is going to erupt. You have to wait and be patient until it occurs and then try to capture it at the moment. And I think a lot of parapsychological phenomena, the real phenomena, the strong phenomena, are like that. You know, they're very different than just trying to flip cards and predict which one comes up or, you know, which one someone else is looking at. I'm not belittling those types of laboratory studies because they're important, but they don't necessarily replicate the phenomena, we'll call it, in the field, in nature.
That's a very good point, Professor, because, as you say, there are many things within hard science that aren't necessarily repeatable.
Exactly.
And there aren't things in hard science that scientists can count on to continually happen. Replication is not necessarily a part of science. There's also things like chaos theory, which,
exactly,
you know, weather patterns. You know, try and meet a meteorologist who can give you the exact weather for next week.
Exactly. Or you make me think of it now, something else in the sky, meteorites, meteors and meteorites. There are a lot of, and I know, I mean, there are a lot of very good people, because it ties in with geologists, they're often in geology departments, people that study meteorites, you know, which of course are objects that came from out of space. And until about 200 years ago, people, you know, the best scientists in the world argued that rocks do not fall out of the sky from nowhere. You know, that basically meteorites, all these reports, anecdotal reports of meteorites were nonsense. Rocks don't fall out of the sky. And that was a very common view. And now, of course, we know better than that. But getting back to my first point I wanted to make, you have a lot of people that study meteorites. They themselves have never personally witnessed one fall out of the sky and land and be able to pick it up.
Right, so there's a lot of inference in what they do. If they've never, unless they've seen one fall, they can't be absolutely certain where it came from.
Exactly.
Oh, inference is a big part of science, and that's...
And it's a legitimate part.
Oh, definitely. I mean, Louis Pasteur inferred that there were tiny microscopic things that caused disease. Microscopes weren't strong enough to see microbes at the time. So what if, you know, a lot of people tried to debunk him. Newton and gravity. Can you show me gravity? They thought he was a hermeticist.
Exactly.
An occultist. So many of these ideas we take for granted are inferred or implied, and they're not directly empirically demonstrable, which is what you really have to think about when you look at psychical research. The data, there's no data in anything that comes up perfect. Ask an actuary for an insurance company. You know, there's a large margin of error. Many things.
Exactly. And, you know, sometimes people make comments, oh, well, you can't control telepathy, or you can't control psychical, you know, so-called phenomena, because they want to say so-called, and they want to just dismiss it all. Here's another analogy, just as we're using analogies. A couple of hundred years ago, electricity, absolutely no control over it. You know, you'd see these huge natural lightning flashes. Somehow that was relayed. You've got Ben Franklin flying his kite, etc. You've got people building up static charges and then releasing them. You know, in some cases, if you've got a big enough charge with horrendous results because it can kill someone, who would have imagined a couple of hundred years ago, 250 years ago, say, that, you know, you and I would be talking on the telephone because of this thing called electricity, because we've now got such incredible control over it.
Oh, amazing. Yeah, amazing. And there again, just not long ago, it was a very mysterious sort of thing.
Exactly. You know, they doubted that it really existed, or that the so-called phenomena that were being ascribed to electricity were all the same thing, all variations on a theme.
Again, for our streaming listeners, this is Sphinx Radio. I'm William H. Kennedy. We're talking to Professor Robert Schock of Boston University, and we're going over a wonderful anthology he put together with a co-author called The Parapsychology Revolution, and it's an excellent anthology of just great articles on parapsychology studies, the paranormal, psychical research. Now, Professor, if you don't mind if I subject hop a little, I noticed on your webpage, which is robertschock.com, and Schock is spelled S-C-H-O-C-H, robertschock.com, you do some tours to Egypt. You're primarily known as someone who has redated the Sphinx on the Giza Plateau in Egypt. And could you tell our listeners what one of these trips to Egypt would entail?
Oh, sure. I do different things different times, but right now, if enough people are interested, I'm planning one for this coming June for the summer solstice, and we would go over there. The plateau actually has alignments in June. The setting sun sets right between the pyramids, and in conjunction are aligned with the Great Sphinx, it's a really a wonderful opportunity. But basically, I take people around, and we can talk about my research, my dating. I usually get people into the actual Sphinx enclosure, which is no longer open to the public. We'll go into the Great Pyramid. If talk about tying in with psychical research, a lot of people have had, psychical experiences or paranormal experiences in the Great Pyramid. And the place that I think is most potent in that sense, and this is from, you know, both personal experience, should we say, and experience of others, but also came back to, we were talking about the Pear Laboratories, the Princeton Engineering Anomaly Research Laboratories. They took, when they were still open, random event generators into the Great Pyramid, and the place where they got the most response, we'll call it that, was down in the subterranean chamber, down below the base of the Great Pyramid. So whenever I take people to the Great Pyramid or to Egypt, I try to get in there also, because it's generally not accessible to the public. But since I've been there so many times, I have contacts, and I can usually get it. Often get people in there. We'll explore the Giza Plateau, the Great Pyramid, the Great Sphinx, the other structures on the plateau. We'll explore the Saqqara Plateau, where the famous Step Pyramid is, outside of Cairo. Then we will fly down to Luxor in what's known as Middle Egypt, and Luxor has incredible temples. The Temple of Luxor itself is one of the most magnificent structures in the world. Well, I hate to say it, maybe I'm a little biased, but a lot of the most magnificent structures in the world occur in Egypt, at least among ancient structures. But we'll go there. That's very pivotal to certain reinterpretations of ancient Egyptian culture and philosophy. philosophy and civilization, because it's been shown that the Temple of Luxor has all kinds of harmonic proportions that were never realized into very detailed analysis in the 20th century by a person that some of your readers may be familiar with, Schwalbe de Lubitsch, philosopher and thinker, alchemist also, actually, in the loose sense of the term, but very pivotal to that thinking. So we'll talk about that. We'll go over to what's known as the West Bank across the river. We'll see Hatshepsut's temple, which is an incredible structure. We'll go into the Valley of the Kings, visit some of the tombs there. I want sometimes I play it by ear of what I can get into that's really good, but, you know, nothing is bad in Egypt. Then we'll actually board a boat and take a cruise down, well, I should say, when I say down the Nile, it's technically up the Nile, going toward Aswan, going upstream, but going south on to Aswan, and we'll stop at various sites and temples and points of interest along the way there, and finally arrive at Aswan, see Aswan, which is a wonderful Egyptian city in the very far south, very dramatic. It's interesting, a lot of people who haven't been to Egypt, it's all Egypt, they all give you a sense of Egypt, but Cairo in the north and Aswan in the south, Luxor in the middle, they all have their own antiquities, of course, their own sites, but also just general air about them, even in modern times. So we'll spend time in Aswan, we'll see the quarries where a lot of the obelisks were initially carved and then moved downstream to other parts of Egypt. And finally, just to summarize, finally we'll fly back to Cairo, spend a little more time there, because there's so much to see in the Cairo area, before we take off again. Have to end at some point.
Wow, that's incredible. And
yeah, it's always a wonderful, wonderful time in Egypt.
Now, people can get information on this trip at robertschoch.com. Schoch is spelled S-C-H-O-C-H, robertschoch.com. And John Anthony West, the other, you know, another big writer who's been on this program as well, he accompanies you as well, is that correct?
Yeah, well, we've never done this before, honestly. John West and I, of course, have spent much time in Egypt together working on the Sphinx and working on other things. And once in a while, you know, people have tagged along. But he and I have actually never done a, we'll call it a tour like this together.
A dual tour. Oh, that would be fascinating. Wow.
And he's done them separately. I've done them separately many times for both of us. But we've actually never done something in conjunction like this. And I don't want to sound like I'm pushing it, but, you know, we both have our own separate lives and we're both busy. And, you know, we'll go over there for research together. But to actually do a tour like this together, you know, we decide we'd try it, see if enough people are interested in it, and it may be a once-in-a-chance. Chance, as they say, to get both of us together.
You get your money's worth on this one, John Anthony West and Professor Robert Schoch.
Yeah, because we'll be with the whole group the entire time, you know, talking, giving our interpretations, discussing it, and of course, you know, this is an opportune time for people that are really interested in the topic to come to talk to us about it, question us on site, you know. It'll be wonderful.
That's great. And people, again, they can get information at robertschoch.com. Now, one more final subject jump, and then I'll let you go, Professor Schoch. Professor Robert Schoch, I ask all of my guests this question. What do you think is the oldest civilization in the world?
The oldest civilization in the world?
Yes.
I don't want to sound the wrong way, but that really depends on how you define civilization, that type of thing. I will give you an answer, though. Right now, depending on what you define as civilization, depending on what you take as, you know, good solid evidence, I think we have evidence in Egypt, and I'm not just biased toward Egypt, but of course I've done a lot of work on redating the Sphinx, and the fact is, based on my analysis, and I'm, you know, all the research I do, I continue to question myself, other people question it, we look at more data, and all the data indicates that the oldest portions of the Sphinx, the core body of the Sphinx, go back thousands of years earlier than dynastic Egypt. So we're pushing, you know, at this point, we're pushing 10,000 BC or more. The other site that has really come to attention recently is Göbekli Tepe in Turkey. And I don't know if your listeners are familiar with this site, but it's in Turkey just north of the Syrian border, and there are huge monolithic stone remains. It sort of reminds some people of Stonehenge, but not exactly, because they're much better carved. They're sort of T-shaped. They have reliefs on them. Some of those reliefs are actually very similar to what you get in pre-dynastic Egypt on some of the palettes. What they call pallets, carved pallets. So there seem to be similarities here, not that far apart. And that site is well dated to going back to the period of about 10,000 BC. So it looks like in both of these, in a more general sense, are part of the, you know, the Middle East. It looks like in that area we have, right at the end of the last ice age, really what undoubtedly a civilization and high culture. Now, if you want to go back even further, I think as we're looking at even Ice Age people in Europe and elsewhere, we are finding that they are much more sophisticated than people have traditionally thought. So, you know, some of the things like as far as music, potential, you know, symbolic systems, etc., they're getting pushed way back into tens of thousands of years. Same with the Far East. So I think this is really a field that is continuing to develop. And everywhere we look, the evidence is just going back further and further.
Yeah, it's really tough to say, yeah.
Yeah, it's really tough to say. I mean, you know, so... but right now, I mean, it's very clear to me we've got in Egypt and we've got in Göbekli Tepe, that site in Turkey, and similar sites connected with both of them. You know, there's no doubt you've got civilization and high culture at a very early period.
Very good. And now we're out of time, Professor Schock, but once more I'll give out your web address. It's robertschock.com. Schock is spelled S-C-H-O-C-H, robertschock.com. I'd like to thank you for coming back on Sphinx Radio. Hang on to the line, and will you come back again and give us an update?
Absolutely. It's always my pleasure.
Thank you, Professor Schock.
Thank you.